The rule is you don't talk politics at work, right? Well, what if work used to be at the Federal Reserve? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 28th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Regular listeners of this program and devotees of business and financial news writ large, I imagine, will probably know that the Federal Reserve has two things it is required by law to do. It's called the dual mandate. Stable prices, that is, inflation that's not too hot, not too cold, but just right. And then a co-equal part of the Fed's job, maximum employment. You'll notice that nowhere in there does it say, publish an op-ed in Bloomberg calling on the Federal Reserve to actively oppose the president's economic policies, and while you're at it, think long and hard while you're setting your interest rate policies about who you want to win the next presidential election. But publish such an op-ed William Dudley did yesterday. Dudley is the former, and that's important, he's the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, so he's a civilian now, and he can say whatever he wants. But believe me when I tell you that some eyebrows were raised when that op-ed dropped yesterday. We didn't talk about it on the program yesterday because of who we've got on the program today, and we wanted to talk to him about it. Robert Kaplan is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Mr. Kaplan, good to see you again, sir.
Great to see you, Kai.
I don't know if you happened to hear the program yesterday. Did you catch it?
I did not.
All right. Well, you should have, because I gave you a heads up as to what the first question was going to be.
Okay.
Obviously, I can't have you in here the day after Bill Dudley drops that op-ed, in which he says, not only should the Fed not enable Mr. Trump's trade war, but you ought to think about the 2020 campaign when you're thinking about your economic policy stance.
Yeah.
With the understanding that you don't speak for the Fed, and the Fed has come out with a statement that says, we're only focused on two things, dual
That's
mandate
right.
and full employment. What did you make of what Mr. Dudley said?
The only comment I would make is consistent with the statement that that Michelle Smith put out on mm-hmm. behalf of the Fed, our work and our decisions are based on our analysis of the economy and the best decisions for the country without regard to political considerations or political influence. I've been at the Fed now close to 4 years. Mm-hmm. That's been true every day that I've been here, and I see no evidence of any behavior to the contrary. So I don't want to comment on any particular piece from someone now on the outside, but I am quite confident that we will behave in a way that meets our dual mandate objectives without regard to any political considerations or political influence at all.
Fair enough, and I expected as much. But the follow-on goes like this.
Yeah.
You've been there 4 years.
Yeah.
You've seen a lot. Are we through the looking glass now with the president beating up on the Fed and Bill Dudley saying what he said and you all hunkering down and saying, you know what, we got two jobs and we're doing them, by God?
Listen, I think we've got a very high-quality group of people around the table. Most of us have been around for a long time. We're somewhat of a quote-unquote older group, thick skin. I think that's part of the job. Criticism is part of this job. People outside the Fed are free to say whatever they believe. We're going to be criticized. We want to act independently, but we have to earn that independence. And I think that's the challenge, and it's never been truer than today. And I'm quite confident we'll fulfill that challenge.
Speaking of challenges, you've got one in the global economy and what it's doing here.
Yeah.
Give me with the caveat that you're not an economist, give me your analysis of where things sit.
So here's the way I see the economy. On the bright side, the consumer's strong.
Yep.
And the consumer is approximately 70% of the economy. And if the consumer stays strong, and if I knew that was going to be the case, it gives me a lot of confidence the economy is going to be solid.
However come, right?
The issue is manufacturing's weak, probably weaker than it's been in 10 years, and global growth is decelerating, and the trade tensions and trade uncertainties are part of the weakness in both. And what I'm concerned about is, does that weakness intensify? And what'll happen is the consumer is a lagging indicator, meaning it'll be the last to go. Maybe X number of months from now, you'll see a weak jobs report.
Yep.
Or one or two, and all of a sudden, consumer will weaken. in my view, if we wait for that to happen, we've waited too long. So I'm on heightened alert to see whether this weakness continues and intensifies. That's where we are right now.
Let me read between the lines on that whole waiting too long thing. The Fed meets next month. Obviously, the FOMC does, talking about interest rates. Do I hear you saying you'd support another interest rate cut?
I'll say today, and I've said publicly, I won't make a decision until I get to the meeting, but I'm very constructive on the thought that we may need to make an adjustment and be open to making an adjustment in our policy rate. Our job is to look forward and is to risk manage. And one of the reality checks for me on that risk management, there's been a lot of talk about the yield curve and the shape of it. For me, the bigger message from the yield curve is it's come down. The whole curve has moved down dramatically.
Everything from 6 months to 30 years.
It's
all cheaper now.
To the point where now the Fed funds rate, the rate we set, is even above the 30-year rate. That's a reality check. And part of it is expectations of future growth have gotten a lot more pessimistic. And for me, that's a reality check that that I ought to be open-minded and constructive about needing to adjust the policy rate.
Last thing, and I'll let you go. And I guess I'll preface this by saying I don't know you from Adam other than these two interviews and the reading I've done about you. You strike me as a generally positive, upbeat, yeah, we can do this kind of guy. Fair?
Yes.
Okay.
That's why I'm doing this job.
Well, that kind of goes to it. So, and let me circle back to where we started. Without getting into the politics and the president and Bill Dudley and all of that, do you believe you at the Fed are equipped to deal with what pretty much everybody believes is coming?
Yeah. And so I've been, been pretty vocal about this now for a few years. Monetary policy has a key role to play.
Right.
But we've gotten a little bit used to in this country thinking that the bulk of our economic policy is monetary policy.
Right.
And part of my job is to flag for people, well, no, it's not supposed to be that way. We need to improve education, skill training. We need infrastructure spending in the United States. And all those things are away from the remit of the Fed. Fed is going to have a critical role to play. But part of my job, I believe strongly, is to call out our analysis broadly of the economy, share it with elected and appointed officials, because we're going to need broader economic policy than just monetary policy if we're going to reach our growth potential.
Robert Kaplan is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, Texas. Mr. Kaplan, thanks for coming in, sir. I appreciate
Great
it.
Great to see you, Kai.
We called Bill Dudley, by the way, to see if he would care to expand on his op-ed. He said he would just as soon let it speak for itself. On Wall Street today, look, here's the deal. Traders and the algorithms they love know that they are going to get a rate cut when the Fed meets next month. So you can take the trade war and Brexit and maybe a recession at some point and just stick your fingers in your ears and say, la, 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 can't hear you. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's play see if you can spot the trend, shall we? There are reports today that Google is looking to move production of its Pixel phones out of China. The CEO of Hasbro said on CNBC yesterday that shifting its manufacturing out of China has, quote, gone very well for us. And last week, an executive at Home Depot said he is, and again, this is a quote, not aware of a single supplier who was not moving some form of manufacturing outside of China. For a lot of companies, the move out of China predates the trade war. But as Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson reports, heck yeah, those tariffs are adding extra motivation.
China's long been the place to go when you wanted to make things for cheap. But for years now, production costs there have been rising. Nick Consonary is with the Eurasia Group.
China's facing labor shortages in key manufacturing centers. You know, resource production costs are increasing as the Chinese government is imposing more rigorous environmental controls.
So when you add on the extra costs of tariffs, companies are looking to at least diversify where they make or buy things. In the first half of the year, U.S. imports of goods from Vietnam and Cambodia rose about 30% compared to the same period last year, while imports from China fell 12%. Wing Tai Wu at UC Davis says those countries offer cheaper labor. Take Vietnam, for example.
Vietnam still has got a significant amount of surplus agricultural labor. And so they can shift a lot of people into industrial jobs without requiring wages to rise.
But manufacturing in China has some advantages that just aren't easily replicated elsewhere, says Peter Petrie at Brandeis University.
There's this very complex, finely tuned, and very efficient supply chain. Now, that doesn't yet exist in Vietnam.
In addition to assembly facilities for cell phones, for example, Petrie says China has a vast supply chain of parts, small screws, plastic components, screens, the glass that goes in front of screens, which means that for at least a while, China still has an edge when it comes to more sophisticated manufacturing. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
One of the realities of consumer spending when things start to slow down is that shoppers at the top of the financial food chain are usually the last to cut back for obvious reasons, right? More money, more spending. But like everything else about the evolving economic times we're living in, that constant might also be changing. The luxury retailer Tiffany reported this morning same-store sales in the United States, Canada, and Latin America fell 4% in the last quarter, 5% over the first half of the year. One big reason? Less spending by foreign tourists, as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports.
U.S. retailers, especially ones that sell luxury products like jewelry, do pretty well with tourists.
They spend a lot of money, they spend on very profitable merchandise, and they contribute a lot to companies' sales and earnings.
But Dana Telsey, a retail analyst, says that's been changing.
Macy's, Ralph Lauren, Tapestry, Michael Kors, luxury brands have been impacted by slower tourist spending and fewer tourists coming to the U.S.
Typically, the tourists who spend the most are from China. According to the U.S. Travel Association, they drop $6,700 a person on average when they visit. Cornell professor Peng Liu has studied Chinese tourism to America.
One of the reasons they like to travel to the United States is to buy things, especially to purchase luxury brand merchandise.
But tourism from China started falling last year for the first time in more than a decade. Clayton Duby, who directs the USC-US-China Institute, says you can blame the slowing Chinese economy, also the trade war.
And the suggestion from the Chinese state that perhaps visitors from China to the United States will be less welcome than they have been, that some of them might even be subjected to official harassment.
Chinese consumers are still spending at Tiffany and other luxury retailers in China, but not quite enough to make up for what they're not spending in the U.S. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Talks are still preliminary, apparently, and reports are still just reports. But if they turn out to be true, the Sackler family could be getting ready to give up control of Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin, probably the best known of the drugs at the heart of the opioid crisis. Part of the deal, again, it's just reported, would settle the more than 2,000 lawsuits currently pending in return for a joint payment by the company and the family of somewhere between $10 and $12 billion. Caitlin Esch has been covering the opioid crisis for our podcast, The Uncertain Hour. Caitlin, it's good to have you in the studio.
Glad to be here.
So you have been out there in these towns and the cities where these drugs have had the most impact. And while $10 billion sounds like a lot of money, I wonder how far it goes when they're out there, because these places are having to spend on police forces, on jails, on rehab. What's it like out there?
Yeah, the costs on the ground are real. We spent a lot of time in Wise County, which is in the southwest corner of Virginia. And a lot of cities and counties in that area are also suing Purdue Pharma and other drug companies. For example, the regional jail population has more than doubled in the 14 years since it was built. Wise County's spending on incarceration has more than tripled in the past decade. And then, of course, there are costs associated with running the courts and foster care and health care. not to mention the lives lost to overdose death and incarceration.
You spent time with a bunch of people out there. I want to talk about two of them. One of them was like a sheriff or a cop, right?
Right.
Yeah.
An undercover narcotics officer. We followed him over the course of about 2 years. He had been in the lumber business, but yeah, he said that he had trouble finding enough workers. So he became an undercover cop, decided to fight the forces that he believed were contributing to bringing down his business.
And he had trouble finding workers in part because of the opioid crisis?
He said he had trouble finding workers that were sober and would show up to work on time, pass a drug test.
Right. Speaking of that kind of person, the other guy you spent a lot of time with, I forget his name. He's the guy who went in and out of jail. Remind me.
Joey Ballard.
Yeah.
We followed him over a couple of years as he struggled with substance use disorder. He had started on pain pills in the 90s when he was in high school and right after high school. And he was sober when I first met him, but then he relapsed and was in and out of jail, had switched from pain pills to methamphetamine, which is what he was on most recently.
There was a scene in one of the episodes of that season where you were on the phone with him and he was in jail, right?
Right. And actually, he's still in jail. He is waiting to be moved to an incarcerated kind of boot camp treatment style program, but he's still in the same regional jail.
So spitball this for me, right? And get me back to where we started. $10, $12 billion, a lot of money. Who knows how much is coming from other companies like Johnson & Johnson and Walmart and CVS and all these other places. Is that going to do it?
Well, I mean, a big bone of contention is how that money will be divvied up and when it'll actually get to these communities. I think it sounds like a lot of money, but it may not go as far as you know, some of these communities are hoping.
Caitlin Esch and a podcast that she and Chrissy Clark worked on last season, a lot of it in Wise County. It's called The Uncertain Hour. Caitlin, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up.
This out-of-office gag has gotten a bit long, long, long.
Vacation season is wrapping up, folks, but not before a quick visit to Abbey Road. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 258 today, 1%, 26,036. The NASDAQ rose 29 points, 0.3%, 78.56. The S&P 500 up 18 points, about 0.6%, 28.87. Energy stocks got a jolt from higher oil prices today. Valero gained 1.4%. Cimarex Energy charged up 10.5%. ExxonMobil improved 0.7%. Tiffany, we told you about, polished up 3% today as its second quarter earnings beat expectations. The cosmetics firm Coty sweetened 6% after raising its full-year revenue forecast. The company has a turnaround plan that includes spending more on advertising while cutting overall costs. So we'll see how that goes. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.46%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Now. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We're launching a new series today that we are calling Adventures in Housing, because more and more that's what finding an affordable place to live has turned into. These will be stories about the workarounds and the compromises, about buying and selling, renting and moving, the dorms and the shacks and the money pits and the houseboats and the yurts and, well, you see where I'm going, right? We start today with what one can safely call a trend that's popping up in backyards around the country, something called ADUs, accessory dwelling units. That's the fancy name. The vernacular is granny flat or in-law apartment. In a lot of cities where housing prices are getting pretty steep, ADUs are seen as one solution to the shortage of affordable housing. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the story of how one couple's ADU plans worked out a little differently than they expected.
First, the intros. Nate Jenkins is an architect. His wife, a pharmacist, is Stacy Jenkins Jenkins.
So my maiden name is Jenkins with a G-I, and his name is Jenkins with a J-E. Who can pass that up? It's legal. I hyphenated it.
In 2012, Jenkins and Jenkins Jenkins, you know what? I'm just going to call them Nate and Stacy. They bought a sweet little brick bungalow close to downtown Denver with a big backyard.
It came with a small garage that was, you know, equipped to fit a Model T in 1913 and not equipped to fit much else.
But the property was zoned for a separate dwelling in the backyard, so they tore down the little garage and built a bigger one with an apartment on top. For Nate, it was kind of an insurance policy.
In 2008, I lost my job as an architect and interviewed for jobs in 16 cities and outside of the country and wasn't able to find work.
The plan was to rent out the accessory dwelling unit so they'd have some extra income. But as it took shape, the new place started looking better than their house. It was air-conditioned. The floors didn't squeak. Then they saw this documentary, Minimalism.
There's nothing wrong with consumption. The problem is compulsory consumption.
It provided me some pause to think about just how much stuff we had and how much clutter that you end up with.
We just decided to go for it and move in.
To the accessory dwelling unit in the backyard. They ditched half their clothes and much of their furniture, rented out the 2,200 square foot house, and downsized to 642 square feet.
All right, so here you go.
It's modern and bright, with high ceilings and skylights. Creative storage, the stairs up to a loft double as cabinets.
Every square inch has a purpose.
Sometimes there weren't enough square inches. They couldn't fit a dining table, so they ate from a little ottoman on wheels. Nate had to learn to work in the same room where Stacy was watching House Hunters. There was nowhere else to go, but they got used to it.
I just think because of the volume of the ceilings makes it feel like you're not in a tiny home, which I would call it sometimes would be our tiny house.
Now there's another tiny house across from them and a few more down the alley.
It's definitely beautified the alley. It's added safety and activity to the alley.
And created a whole new community. While we're talking, a delivery truck pulls up.
This is the daily package delivery that our little compound has here.
We lovingly call it the compound because there's several families that live here. So on Sundays, we would have parties and the whole neighborhood would come over and get to know each other as neighbors. Yeah, we kind of miss it.
She misses it because after 2 years, they recently moved out. They're expecting a baby Jenkins Jenkins in the fall. So they rented out their tiny house and bought another big one a few blocks over.
I absolutely do think it's too big. Even with a child, I don't think we'll ever need the space that we have there.
But the new place is also zoned for an accessory dwelling unit. They might just do it again. In Denver, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There will be more adventures in housing, occasional stories of how people live today. Help us out. Send us your ideas, would you? You can do it at marketplace.org. There was a movie that came out earlier this summer imagining a world in which the Beatles never existed. When you start to think about how many Beatles songs you can probably name off the top of your head, a world like that seems unimaginable, actually. Because when you think about it, the library of instantly recognizable Beatles tunes is so big it's almost a language unto itself. Case in point, this next installment of our series, Automatic Reply. Some of the more creative ways that people say, I might not answer your email right away.
Hello, I would love to.
Help, I need somebody. Help.
But I'm out of the office, so.
You won't see me.
You won't see me. For a week. But don't worry.
It won't be long, yeah.
Until I return. It's my son's 13th birthday, so the two of us left to drive my car on a road trip. 13 years old. It seems like just.
Yesterday.
He was a.
Little child.
I'm really excited and hope this trip is something he still remembers.
When I'm 64.
I'll be back in a week, but if it's something important,
oh, won't you?
To call or text me
anytime at all.
On my cell phone. If you can
let it be, let it be, let it be.
Until I
get back.
That'll be even better, because things are likely to be a little bit this week. I'll do my best to make any outstanding assignments as soon as I can. Okay.
I've got a feeling
that this out of office gag has gotten a bit long, long, long. So this is
the end. The love you take is equal to the love you make.
Eric Robbins, a lawyer in Chicago. His actual out-of-office email, by the way, had way more Beatles references than we have time for here. You can check out all 49 of them and tell us about an automatic reply that you have seen at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, being fully aware that foreign exchange trading can be risky. If you are headed to London anytime soon, the currency markets are your friend. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has asked the Queen, as you know, and she has agreed to suspend Parliament for a longer while than usual in September and October as Johnson tries to figure out Brexit. The deadline is Halloween. Negotiations have not been fruitful. A no-deal Brexit would be a big problem, and so currency traders sent the pound down to $1.21 and a bit this morning on the prorogation news. Before the Brexit vote, by the way, 3 years ago, a pound would have cost you $1.44. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrials up 258 today, 1%. The NASDAQ up 29.3%. S&P 500 up 18.6% there. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.